Alright, so what I'm going to do is, and this is a little bit of a false advertising, I guess, shall we talk about that, is what have we learned from 30 years of research on mergers and acquisitions. I started out and I created this presentation, and then I realized it was way too long, so I trimmed and I trimmed again. So you know, I don't want you to come away thinking what I've done fucking, this is all we've learned for 30 years of research, but this will be sort of the highlights. So I want to start off by just sort of putting things in context. I want to give you sort of big picture, and then we're going to drill down to some more direct takeaways. So just to give you a sense of where we are, so this is just looking at the last basically 30 years of M&A activity, and you can see that here's the 90s merger wave. We used to think that this was quite a bit of activity in the 80s, but it sort of pales in comparison to global activity. And then here's the, whatever we're calling this, the aughts. And, of course, the financial crisis happened and we had a precipitous drop-off in M&A activity. If you want to see a more striking picture, then we can look at LBO activity. And I think, you know, there was a lot of news about the LBO market in the last few years. And one of the things you see is that was for good reason. We're seeing really unprecedented activity by private equity in the M&A market in the sort of mid-aughts here. And it just dropped off a cliff with the financial crisis, which makes sense because one of the things that happened was the credit markets just basically seized up as people remember that debt actually does have risk. And that's a sort of major component to the recipe that the private equity sponsors play out. And so it really, while the M&A activity is quite a bit lower from its high in 2009, it's not totally anemic in the sense that it's still reasonably high historically, whereas the LBO activity is really just a whole new world again. They're really back down to some serious lows. And they're not going to see a pickup again until we see a real change in the credit markets. Now, to take a broader, longer time series, you start to see that the patterns that I was showing you there on the previous slides are somewhat regular in the sense that one of the things that we do know about mergers, especially in the aggregate, is that they cluster in time. So we call these merger waves. And actually, if I had the data to easily show it to you, there's one at the turn of the 20th century that people call the monopolization wave that actually sort of gave rise to most of the antitrust acts. Then this is sort of the scale economies wave is what people call this. What you had going on here was electrification and railroads made some truly national enterprise feasible for the first time. And so there was a sort of a scale economies wave there, which was cut off by the stock market crash and the ensuing depression. And then you have what most people refer to as the conglomerate merger wave of the 60s. Conglomerates were suddenly in vogue, the idea of a big diversified enterprise touching lots of different sectors. We saw a lot of firms acquiring to become conglomerates. This turned out not to be such a great idea. It turns out managers are good at managing sort of one thing, not a whole bunch of different sectors. And so we saw the bust up focus wave, merger wave of the 80s. And part of this was also fueled by the financial innovation of using highly leveraged deals and using the junk bond market to fund a takeover. I should mention that this scale is a little bit different than the previous scales. This is fraction of stock market part, so it actually takes into account the growth in the economy. So it sort of makes things a little bit more even in comparison. Then there was the 90s merger wave. Some people call this the global wave. We haven't sort of settled on a name. And then there was the most recent one, and of course the drop-off. This only has until 2008 data. So one of the questions that we struggle with, or have struggled with, is what causes this clustering of merger activity? Why is there so much activity at once? Is this a rational thing where we're reshuffling assets for good reason? Is this driven by just excesses in the stock market? Because if you sort of look carefully at these previous waves, they tend to happen when things are going well in the economy, the stock market is up. And certainly there is a lot to the fact that there's more reshuffling of assets when the economy is going well. But I want to show you this picture. Now, this is a pretty complicated picture, so bear with me for a second. this is, we've already looked at this. The red bars is merger activity in the aggregate. The gray bars are industry clusters of merger activity. So, for example, these two are two merger waves in the banking industry, these two gray bars. And so these are each on the horizontal or vertically, these are different industries. And one thing you want to take away from this is that when you see aggregate peaks of merger activity, what's really going on is that there's a lot of individual industries undergoing peaks in their own merger activity basically at the same time, and that's building up to create an aggregate wave. So there's a lot of different reasons. There are shocks to the industry's operating environment. They may be technological, they may be deregulatory, they may be economic, increased import penetration, for example. And that's causing, that's giving good reason for these industries to reshuffle assets. Now, the reason, you would say, well, why do all these shocks have to take place at the same time? Why should we have them all lining up? The shocks don't take place at the same time, but not every shock propagates a merger wave. What you need to have is you need to have enough capital liquidity in the economy. Basically, you have to have the grease that drives the wheels of reshuffling the assets. And so what I have here, this line, this represents the spread between the rate that banks charge on commercial industrial loans and the underlying Fed funds rate. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, every merger is funded by borrowing, but this rate in economics turns out to be highly related to sort of how easy it is to get things financed, via debt or via through the capital markets in general. So this is sort of a measure of how dear is financing. So you see, you know, remember what was going on in the early 80s. It's not surprising that this was way up here. And what you want to see is that basically when this line is going down, credit is easing, markets are more receptive to deals, and you start to then, with a lag, you see activity going up. When it goes up, with a lag, you see activity going down. And so it was coming down, activity went up, it started going up, activity dropped off. Now, of course, the next question is, well, what does that mean for us now? So I actually pushed this forward to the current situation. And so what you see is basically with what's been going on in the credit markets, we've seen this spread get to heights that we really haven't seen since the early 80s. And, of course, it's gone with it a big drop-off in merger activity. And so what that suggests to me is that, you know, we're really not going to see a big pickup in activity until people start feeling more comfortable with financing deals. We're seeing a lot of skepticism, and only sort of the best deals are getting financed, or deals where firms that have a very conservative balance sheet and have come through the crisis with a fair amount of liquidity are able to do strategic deals. Now, in terms of understanding more about how this merger activity clusters and how does an individual industry end up undergoing merger waves, I'm going to show you a piece from, this is an incomplete work that I have with a co-author, where we're basically looking at the economy as an interconnected network. You know, industries sell and buy from each other. And what we want to understand is how does a shock to one particular industry propagate through this network, through the economy, and affect other industries. And so a shock might cause consolidation wave in one industry that your own industry is either directly or indirectly connected through up or down the supply chain, and that's going to have implications for you down the road. And so just to give you an example, this is the timber network. And so, for example, you have forestry supplies, forest nurseries, we supply logging, we supply sawmills, we supply wood doors and pulp mills. And there's different kinds of connections going in different directions. The reason why I want to show you this example is there was a nice exogenous shock to this network that we all know well, which is that in 1990, the spotted owl was added to the threatened list. And 24 million acres of timberland were taken off the table, basically. And so what do we see happen? Well, first, there was a consolidation wave in sawmills, then forest nurseries, then logging, and then pulp mills. And it's a little bit harder to see here when you look at it on this graph, but when I shift the time of each one to allow for the lags in transmission of the shock through the network, it's actually quite striking how similar in intensity and duration the merger waves were in each of the interconnected industries. And so what our research is working on is sort of how can we understand how these shocks propagate further, not even just within the particular network, but further down the line within the economy to affect even somewhat only indirectly connected industries. So now I'm going to move from sort of the aggregate picture of what drives overall merger activity to sort of what have we learned from a study of individual deals. And what I want to stress here is that most of the studies that I'm going to summarize have looked at thousands of deals over several decades. So there's so much texture in M&A that any individual deal can be different. But this is sort of the stuff that bubbles to the surface as big takeaways from looking at a large sample of deals. So, on average, mergers do create modest values. That's a good thing. All this activity, all these resources, we do see modest value created. However, it's much better to be selling than to be buying. Most of the value that's created in terms of the synergies ends up being transferred to the target shareholders in the form of the premium paid. In fact, if you look at public acquirers, these are publicly traded bidders, over the last 25 years, if you add up all of their acquisition spending, it's $3.4 trillion, and they have a net loss on that in terms of what was the market, the market reaction to their value on the day of the announcement of $303 billion. So I want to talk a little bit more about that figure. And so, of course, the takeaway is that if you're on the buying side, you should consider yourself fortunate just to break even on the acquisition. This picture is pretty striking. What's going on in this picture is we're taking the announcement reaction in terms of the dollar change to the value of the bidding firm when it announces the bid, and we're adding that up across all bidders in a given year. Okay, and so if you see what basically on net, this is basically a push most years, that most bidders break even. Well, in any year, the sort of the gains basically offset the losses. Until the 90s, we saw some of the early movers in the 90s wave tended to, on average, make more money than others lost. But then the late movers at the end of the 90s merger wave just lost tremendous amounts of value. And so what you're seeing here is that aggregate losses in a given year of $250, $300 billion. This is, so AOL, Time Warner's in here, several of AT&T's forays into the cable business are in here. So there were a lot of big, you know, $10 billion market value erased on announcement day kind of deals are in here. And it's taken us a while to get back to sort of, on average, doing deals that make sense. So let me kind of then narrow in on sort of the actual, what's going on at announcement day. You know, so those are, I showed you the aggregate effects of some really bad deals, and so let me talk about some deals that the market does like. And what you're seeing here is this is from 40 trading days before the announcement, day zero is the announcement of the acquisition, to 10 trading days after the announcement, what's going on with the target stock and what's going on with the bidder stock. So here you see this is a typical target run-up. What's going on in here is people are playing hunches, people are trading illegally on inside information. This is what's going on in here, and then the announcement is made, and the target price goes up to something a little bit less than the premium. The bidder stock, what you see is two different things. If the bidder is bidding for a private target, that tends to be well received. If it's bidding for a public target, that tends to be poorly received. And that definitely comes out of the data again and again, is when you bid for a large public target, it tends to be costly in terms of your own value. And so basically, of course, the market likes it when the bidder faces less competition for the target, doesn't get itself into some kind of auction situation, bidding war. Interestingly enough, bidder returns, and this is robust to all kinds of other characteristics, when the bidding firm is smaller, they tend to do better in the acquisition game. And the best current explanation for this is that when the firm is smaller, the managers tend to be more often playing with a little bit of their own money, instead of playing with other people's money. They tend to be more invested in their firm. Paying in cash, basically, anytime you buy something with your own stock, you're sending a signal that you certainly don't think that stock is overvalued, and you probably think it might be, you certainly don't think that stock is undervalued, and you probably think it might be overvalued if you're willing to spend it as currency. So the market takes that into account. acquired a privately held firm. Basically, the bidders seem to be able to get a better deal on valuation of privately held firms. And part of that is that they're giving something of value to the private target owners. They're giving a liquidity event, and they tend to be able to trade that off in the negotiations. And then preserving focus as opposed to diversifying. We learned in the 60s that these diversifying deals are not the best idea. Okay, going forward, how do the deals actually fare? Well, the large sample evidence does support some operating performance improvements going forward. In general, these do seem to be good deals in terms of creating operating synergies. There's some evidence that this may be more concentrated in cash deals than in stock swaps, but it doesn't sort of jump out at you in the data. And then in terms of what about the stockholders? Well, long-term performance for the stock price is generally okay, except there's some evidence that you do poorly if your acquirer was one of these highly valued acquirers, so high market value relative to book value, for example, the so-called glamour acquirers, as opposed to value acquirers, doing stock swaps. So they're basically trading somewhat over value equity. But I should say that doing these long-run stock return studies is actually kind of hard to get right, and so there's a lot of debate about whether this is true. But let me show you a picture of that. This is excess five-year return for bidder stockholders, and what we have here is a small target relative to the bidder up to a target that's fairly large relative to the company that's buying it. And this is what people sort of point to, is that in a cash deal, the bidder shareholders do fine in the long run, but when the bidder is only willing to sort of pay stock for this target, that's when you tend to see the long run losses. These large stock swaps for really big public targets are the deals that tend to be the ones destroying value. Those are the ones that was in that picture with the dip. So to summarize what I've been talking about, the value creation, so on average, mergers do create value for combined shareholders, and this is borne out in the announcement returns, the post-merger operating performance, the long-run returns on average. And this doesn't, I didn't talk about this part of the research, but people have looked to see, is this coming at the expense of bondholders, is this coming at the expense of customers, rivals, etc. There's not a big wealth transfer here. This does appear to be mostly synergy-driven. However, there's this minority of really big deals that destroy value on a massive scale. So although you can have about 80% of deals done are value creative, the other 20% are so big that on net you actually have value loss. So that's something to kind of just chew on a little bit. Okay, well, we've got these big deals. The evidence is clear that big deals tend to destroy value on average. So why do CEOs keep doing them? Well, investment bankers are very persistent in pitching deal ideas to potential bidding CEOs. Target CEOs are going to make out very well through golden parachutes, etc. And it turns out that buyer CEOs end up richer even when the deal goes bad. And let me tell you a little bit about that here. So one interesting study looked at how is the target CEO treated after the deal is completed, and then sort of compared that to the premium that the target shareholders were receiving. So they found that they tend to get a bigger payout if they're not staying on with the combined firm. That makes sense, right? If you get to keep your job or some kind of job with the combined firm, you don't need to have as big of a goodbye package. But the interesting part was that the better the target CEO was treated in terms of having like an ongoing consulting gig or maybe staying on the board or having some position as CEO of the combined firm or as the bidding CEO became chairman, the lower was the premium that the target shareholders got. Okay, so there's a model of what would you expect the premium to be given all the characteristics of the deal, and then sort of what was the actual premium, and it was lower the better the target CEO was treated. And when I talked to practitioners about this study, they said, sure, you point to me and you say, give this guy an extra $2 million and you'll save 50 cents a share. It's a no-brainer, basically, what they said. And it's perfectly, in their mind, it's perfectly ethical because their duty is to their shareholders. They need to get the best deal for their shareholders, not for the target shareholders. So what about the buying CEOs? They get big cash bonuses in years. The blue bars are years when they're doing M&As, and then the brown bars are years when are basically in the same year, similar to CEOs who aren't doing M&A activity, comparing bonus size. And if you read the compensation committee reports, they say, look, they worked hard. They had to really work hard to get this deal negotiated, get it done, get it integrated. They should be paid more for that. So they get a nice little deal bonus. And then also a study that a co-author and I did a couple years ago, we looked going forward. We said, okay, we can't measure the total wealth of a CEO, but we can at least measure their firm-specific wealth. We have access through proxy statements to their portfolio of firm-specific equity and options. And if they do a bad deal, they should suffer because they have a lot of their wealth in their own firm stock and options. But what it turns out is that when they do a bad deal, the board, particularly sort of weak boards, tend to give them a huge new slug of extra equity and options to kind of make up for it, to sort of make them whole. And so what we showed was that what's going on here is the green bars are going forward after the deal is done. These are combined firms that outperform their peers. Red is underperforming their peers, and blue is just taking all of them together. And so what you see is that for 75% of the underperforming deals, so the combined firm is underperforming its peers, the shareholders are suffering, the CEO that made this happen is actually still wealthier than he or she was before the deal. It's not until you get to sort of the bottom 25% that they start to actually be worse off. Now, what I want to make clear is that there's still a clear incentive to do good deals, right? Green bars are higher than red bars. But there's not a lot of disincentive to do bad deals. If it's on the margin, should we do the deal or not, there's basically not a lot of risk to the buying CEO to go ahead with the deal because on average, they're going to be made whole even if the deal flops. So, what do I want to summarize from this sort of 35,000-foot tour of 30 years of M&A research? Basically, the evidence does largely support the synergy-driven hypotheses for the majority of acquisitions, that we are creating value in this, and this doesn't appear to be at the expense of other stakeholders, but the big caveat is that the value creation tends to be transferred to the target shareholders in the form of the premium, so acquiring shareholders are often worse off, and that's particularly the case in these large public acquirer by big public target, particularly with stock deals. But don't worry about the target and acquiring CEOs, they're just fine. Now, looking ahead, one of the things that people are starting to get interested in is the role of government. So this is not a new thing, especially if you've been paying attention to Europe over the past 10 years. The European governments, particularly the French government, have been very active in creating what they call national champions to compete in key industries on a global scale. So this is, so if you follow how Sanofi Aventis ended up becoming Sanofi Aventis, the French government was extremely active in that. It was kind of amusing in the "it's not happening to me" sort of way. But what we're seeing now is that the U.S. government is highly active in sort of particularly pushing firms together in crises, saying, you know, we really need Bank of America to buy Merrill, we really need J.P. Morgan to buy everybody else, and stuff like that. And so this is an interesting issue going forward. Cross-border M&A is becoming a bigger and bigger deal. We're seeing a lot more cross-border acquisitions, not just as a way to enter a new market, but as a way, again, to become that sort of global scale as markets become more globally integrated. We're going to see, especially in the next few years, a lot of strategic acquisitions by liquid firms or firms that have come through this crisis in good shape, and they're going to take advantage of that because they actually have the liquidity in the balance sheet to do these deals. What will be interesting is sort of reference prices. There's a study out right now that hasn't really been fully vetted, but it shows that the sort of 52-week high of the target has an outsized importance in deal negotiations, even though it's sort of irrelevant in terms of what is the target worth to the bidder, that a lot more, that the probability that the deal is going to be accepted and go through is sort of discontinuously high once you reach that 52-week high that the target has been at. And while a lot of firms probably at this point aren't off their 52-week high, they're certainly off their 2-year highs, and whether or not targets have really sort of willing to reset their valuations to the new reality is one of the things that'll be a stickler going forward. And finally, so private equity. It's definitely a game change for private equity. There's a huge flow of private equity into that sector during the boom years. They got this money. It's on the clock. They need to invest it, but the credit markets aren't playing the game anymore. So I'll be interested to see how they sort of reset their expectations. Okay, now one of the things that happens, I'll do the segue for you, baby. One of the big areas that we're starting to get more research in is post-merger integration and how important that is to realizing the value. And of course, one of the things that you end up having to do in post-merger integration is think about overlapping brands and the potential for brand elimination. And Shelley's got a great talk on exactly how to think about those issues.
Thank you, Jared.